recapping the what we did in the last couple of lectures, we define a symplectic space as a even dimensional space D, which we call the phase space, equipped with a closed and non-degenerate two form. Remember, non-degenerate means that it is invertible and that everything is good. So it can be inverted to a Poisson bracket in particular. And this condition is equivalent to Jacobi. And is also making our structures very rigid. In fact, and we know, now that we've done also some exercises, we've seen how much this is used. This is used all the time to prove any sort of identity. Then we define Hamiltonian vector fields, and we notice the following. We know that in a Poisson bracket, we can define a vector field as F with an open slot. And now we ask, when is this relation, like, we define the set of vector fields for which such a function exists. We call them Hamiltonian vector field, and we call the function the Hamiltonian generator. In the symplectic language, this is the equation. And then we notice that the Poisson algebra is essentially represented on the vector, on the Hamiltonian, on the space of Hamiltonian vector field, just as the Lie bracket between. Yesterday we added to the picture a Lie algebra, which acts, which we think of a symmetry, of a Lie algebra of symmetry, which acts on our phase space P. As in the following way, it means that to every psi, to every element of the infinitesimal transformation, like an infinitesimal rotation, for example, it's mapped to some vector field. This vector field, roughly speaking, is, let me write it this way, delta qi edqi plus delta pi edpi. In this sense, when we know how the, for example, the canonical coordinate transform, then we know what the vector is. So this is part of the data. And we say we enforce this to be a homomorphism of Lie algebra, which means that rho, the Lie bracket between the vector field, is rho of the Lie bracket in the Lie algebra. This means that the transformations are nicely represented as transformations of the phase space. And we adopted the following notation for, so here this is a special set of Hamilton of vector fields, and now we want to ask as well, we call this a symmetry, kinematical symmetry, if there is a generator for these transformations. And J, so what is this J? It's a function over phase space valued in the dual. So for example, in the case of rotations, we saw that J of Xi is equal to, so an infinitesimal rotation is a vector, if we want. And these would be P cross Q dot Xi. So P cross Q, we can think of it as this guy with the open index. So This open index corresponds to the fact that it's valued in the dual, so that we can always contract it with an element. So this is what this fancy notation means. It's just what I call the angular momentum is not quite the generating function. It's just is the generating function with the, without the xi. So that's something valued in the dual of the Lie algebra mathematically.
Aldo?
Yeah.
We call it kinematical symmetry if we can find this function. So there are some cases that we cannot find. Are there simple examples that we can?
So we had this example of remember we did we wrote dv wedge dqe plus bij dqi dqj. So this was a way to think about the particle in the presence of a magnetic field, for example. And we see that if we have if b depends on the position, probably translations will not be Hamiltonian. There will not be a generator because in particular, if these such a function exists, the Lie derivative of omega with respect to the symmetry must be zero. I think we showed this. If we didn't, it's very simple. You just use Cartan's formula. When the d is on the right, omega d omega is zero. When d is on the left, is d of this equation. So the right-hand side is again zero. So this means that omega must be invariant under the symmetry. And if this depends on the position, then this will not be invariant under translation. So this is a, an example where translation symmetry cannot be implemented as a kinematical
symmetry. This means the phase space doesn't have that symmetry. It's that simple, right?
Yeah. So there's even no hope to question whether it's preserved by the dynamics. You just stop one step before. Then we say that the symmetry is dynamical if it's also compatible with the dynamics, which means there were many ways of saying this. One of them was to say that this is zero for all xi. So we can also remove the xi and just think of this with the open index. So this is a way to say that. And we saw that this implies that H is preserved by the symmetry and that the dynamics conserves J. Okay. So this is the recap. And finally, what we were trying to do was to close some diagrams. So let me write the diagram. And then we can take some more questions if there are. We have a Poisson algebra. And by restricting, it's inside the Lie algebra of vector fields as the subalgebra of Hamiltonian vector fields is a representation of this Poisson algebra. And now we have this new algebra over here, which is a Lie algebra that a priori knows nothing about phase space, just sitting there. But we saw that we can, through rho, we can put it inside here. And we have already asked that this is a nomomorphism of Lie algebra. So this bracket is mapped to that bracket. It is that equation, right? Okay. So now, to close this diagram, the only arrow that we miss is this one. So now, that's what we're going to do. Is there any question? Or go there?
All the time I can make the two form in a good way, the thing that we proved, right? I can make it dqi, dqi, dp.
DPDQ?
So what happens that when I make it like that, it seems I can restore my symmetry back, right? Because in this game, we don't have symmetry.
Yeah, so it's kind of, you need to know what P means. So since P, in that case, in the case corresponding to that example, was Q, I don't know the sign, minus, let's say, minus A. So this is A of Q. So if you go back to what your theory actually means and how you constructed this coordinate, you know that that dp is dq minus one needs indices, otherwise it's not to work. Dj dqj. Well, A, so we done. So, but this depends on Q. So this is translation invariant, but this isn't. So you always, so phase space is kind in canonical coordinates, knows nothing about the physics in reality. You need to give some input. You need to say what the coordinate means. This could be even angular coordinate on a sphere, which are not in, or on some Riemann surface, and those would not be, there would not be any translation symmetry. So symplectic geometry per se has no knowledge about the physics. It's just a box that you have to put input. So the symmetries, we will see. We will not really work in such a ungrounded context. We will always look at it coming from some Lagrangian, and then it's always clear what the symmetry actually is and how the P's are constructed and so on. So this is just a warm up to know about the notation, gain some intuition, but now starting today or Monday, we'll start working with Lagrangians and from Lagrangians. All the symmetries will be symmetries of the Lagrangian.
If I follow that path and find J has answer in that coordinate, right? I can find the charge for every symmetry that I have, like every Lie algebra, right?
As long as...
If I go in that coordinate, I can find the solution for that J, right? For example, for rotation.
If you have these modulo topological obstructions, if this holds, a J exists.
Point is, it just holds locally. We need to hold every point, right?
Yes. So I'm saying,
that's, yeah.
If this, so this equation implies D of this equation. So if something closed is necessarily exact, so if the cohomology is trivial, the first cohomology is trivial, or the the first, then you can always, for such a row, you can always find the J. But it's a cohomology, it's a global question at that point, not local. The thing that is useful, and let me just mark it briefly, since we have mentioned this, if we have a symplectic potential, which is invariant under this action, then J xi is can be computed like this. So in practice, this is the easiest way to find J, to guess a theta, and if it's also invariant, you won. And usually the theta is PDQ, the right one, or something close to that. Okay, so let's finish this part. So the trick is the following. So let's write the only equation we have. We write it for eta plus is equal to 0. And what I want to do, I lead derive it along another These are called fundamental vector fields. In case, I think I forgot to give the name. These are sometimes called fundamental vector fields. This rho xi. So I take the lead derivative of this equation by this fundamental vector field, and I apply all the Cartan's rules. So this distributes, and here I find the bracket of rho xi rho eta over omega when this hits omega gives zero, and L goes across D. So here I find L of rho psi eta equals zero. Sorry, J eta. Now I want to recognize two things. First one is that this is rho of the bracket, and therefore this is minus I rho of psi eta omega plus d of, what is this? This is the lead derivative along rho, but this is also then the bracket of j psi with j eta. And here, well, I should have. What is this? This is now d, sorry, there is no minus, is d minus d of j of the bracket. So from this, we conclude that d of j of the bracket minus the Poisson bracket of the j's is zero. So we cannot quite conclude that they're equal. They're equal up to a constant. And this constant can, in general, depend on xi and eta.
Did you now use Cartan's formula, or how did you go
here? So I used again that this is a Hamiltonian symmetry, so I can write it as d of the charge. The charge is j xi, and in this case, j of the bracket. And so I write it as d of j of the bracket and pull out the.
And just one more question, what you said before about the symplectic potential. So what goes wrong if the cohomology is not trivial for this computation? Like, does the potential have issues?
Probably you cannot define the global potential. I didn't. So omega is always locally of this form, which we know by from Darboux theorem. But whether you can find a global theta that works. Okay, so in sum, this is not always the case that this is zero. So these arrows can have a little obstruction. This is called. So this quantity that is in here, let me call it kappa xi eta. We know that, so this is, I leave it as an exercise. We know that kappa for all psi and eta is constant because it's d, its derivative is zero. So this is a number. So this is a constant. And one can prove, so this is manifestly anti-symmetric, for example, just from it, the way I defined it. But and then there is the interesting one, which is also not hard to prove. The cyclical sum of psi 1, and here I put a bracket psi 2, psi 3, is equal to 0. So this can be proved, these equalities can be proved from the definition. And they say that this kappa is what is called a Chevalier-Eilenberg cocycle. We will not use it. We will put it to 0. But just as you know, that these can happen. And in Chern-Simons theory, for example, it does happen. I don't have simpler examples in mind where it happens, but that's kind of standard in field theory.
So what happens? It's non-zero.
If in Chern-Simons, the analog of this kappa is non-zero. In Young-Mills, with zero. In gravity, there isn't in, well, it's hard, yeah. OK, so this kappa is a Chevalet. And here I get confused with the spelling, but Eilenberg cocycle. So there is a sort of Lie algebra cohomology put on top and so on. We will not care. We will set it to 0. So by definition, J is said equivariant if the cocycle is 0, essentially. So J is said equivariant if and only if. I could say kappa equals 0, but I want to write it in a nicer way. And I give a couple of different ways to write these. So the first one, if this holds. But in fact, we know that there is a more abstract way of thinking of these as that. And in fact, I can even remove eta to make it look a bit nicer. I can say that the Lie derivative of J as valued in the dual is equal to the adjoint action, the coadjoint action of psi on. So this is the equivariance. It's just in physics you would say it's covariant. It's a covariant object. So angular momentum is a vector that transforms like a vector under rotations without any extra things. And so it's just what this equation is telling you, that the quantity transforms itself under the symmetry in the natural way. So for equivariant maps, is closes. So this is J. J closes this diagram when equivariant. The problem if it's not equivariant is that this algebra, the charge algebra, the Poisson algebra of the charges, can have a cocycle with gain a cocycle with respect to this one. But if it's equivariant, that doesn't happen, and everything is.
But now, is there a relation between when k is equal to 0 and when we have a symmetry?
Ah, OK, very good. So the symmetry. This doesn't quite break the symmetry. It's more, you can think of it as a deformation of the symmetry. The symmetry is represented in your charge algebra in a twisted way. It's like, in quantum mechanics, you can have linear representations and projective representations. This is the precise analog of that statement in the classical theory. So if this cocycle is non-trivial, it means that it cannot be reabsorbed into some redefinitions.
So that's like saying.
And then there are only projective representations of that symmetry.
Yeah.
So there are symmetries up to a phase. And the phase is the fact is essentially given by Scapa.
Is that Bargmann's theorem, or because you just said quantum mechanics dependent on the cohomology, when that is trivial, you can make the projective representations into.
Yeah, I don't know the names of the theorems. The statement is that when you talk about cocycles, it means that you have a cohomology. So there are some trivial cocycles. Trivial cocycles are obtained in the following way. J, by this equation, is only defined up to a constant. Something that does not depend on your point on phase space. So if I shift, if I take an equivariant J and I shift it by a constant, so by an element of the dual of the Lie algebra that it does not depend on phase space point, then this kappa is there, is non-trivial. Well, is there, but is in a sense trivial, can be reabsorbed. And so I don't care about those. So the cocycle is in the Chevalier-Eilenberg cohomology when the symmetry is intrinsically, I don't want to say anomalous, but it's twisted. So we will not encounter this. And in the notes, I give this example of the shift, of shifting it and seeing how this is gives you a cocycle, but which can be reabsorbed. So probably, I would prefer not to, it's a bit confusing, but without giving us too much more. So I would not go there until the end. We can come back. So maybe I should have. Oops. Okay, so this concludes what I wanted to say about the finite dimensional symplectic geometry. And now I want to start moving towards field theory. And for this, I need, unfortunately, a little bit of notation. So this week, we'll finish on something a little boring, but it's needed for to the computations. Let's see if I said everything. So the setup I want to use. So is there any other question about the equivariance beside the cohomology? So. Field theory. So in field theory, of course, there are different layers of things. There is the space-time, and then there is field space. When we think about symplectic geometry for field theory, we have to work on this infinite-dimensional space. So let's start working, like setting up the notations for these. My space-time, I will call it M, and I will always work for simplicity with globally hyperbolic spacetimes. It's not, it's just, it's better not to ask too many questions about this condition. And so what I have, we can think of it as the following situation. So this is a topological condition. Doesn't tell me that the metric on sigma has to be constant. This is a purely topological statement. So here I have one potato. Here I have a different potato of a different shape. And they evolve in time. So in this drawing, I have sigma in and sigma final, initial and final. And they do not need to have the same shape, but they are topologically the same. There's no topological change. And in this picture, I've drawn things in such a way that d sigma has no bound. Well, let me write. D sigma has no bound. So this is M, and d sigma has no bound. But in certain applications, I will be interested of having, of looking just at portions of these sigmas. And now I will have boundaries. Instead of changing names for things, I will just say that in that case, instead of having, I will draw it like this. So there is a sigma initial with its own corner initial, sigma final. M will be here, and there will be some time-like boundary like that. So these are space-like, always in my case. And so in this case, this sigma is C, and the boundary of M. So here, the boundary of M is sigma in sigma final, maybe with some orientation reversed. I will call this normal n. And now here I have an extra normal, which I will call s, because it's space-like. And here is sigma, sigma, in, out. And then there's b, the time-like boundary. We will not really use b much. We will mostly interested in sigma and c. In case, but just to fix notation.
So I'm just trying to understand. In this case, when you're saying d sigma has no boundary, it means that means that each potato is your sigma.
So the potato, what I care about is its surface, not its interior.
Yeah, yeah.
So this is a way to think of this is like radial evolution, if you want. So in that case, you clearly see that there's this boundary is not there because it's the radial direction. It's harder to draw though.
So the R is actually this. Why is like something like B not there in that case?
So the 2D analog, which I can draw on the blackboard, is the following. I have these ring is M, is the 2D spacetime, and its two boundaries are sigma in and sigma out. So there's no boundary in any other direction. But I can also draw these like this. But the, like instead of putting them on the same plane, I look at the cylinder.
Yeah.
But this is not the boundary of the cylinder. This is the cylinder. So M in this picture is the sides of the cylinder, it's not the boundary.
M is
this. So M
is the surface of the cylinder.
Is the surface of the cylinder. And there's nothing here. So this is just nothing.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay? And this is sigma. Sigma is the circle. Then this is the analog of this, but I'm going one dimension more. So instead of a circle, I have a surface.
Yeah, but in this case, both of them don't have, both the sigmas don't have a boundary, right?
Yeah, but.
Here you're saying d sigma is C in this diagram.
I'm replacing this circle with the surface here. And now M is some 3D space. But I cannot draw it in any. So there's here?
Yeah,
so in this case, I'm taking a portion of my sigma and a portion of the other sigma. And now these orange ones are my boundaries. So here I would draw them. They are strips like this. So this strip is this strip. And now this has a space, two space-like boundaries and two time-like boundaries. And this is what I'm drawing here.
And in this case, your boundaries are again two space-like.
This is C. This point is C now.
Okay.
This is sigma, and this is B.
Okay. Yeah. Perfect. Now, so here, but then you are here in this diagram. You're saying there is nothing like C. That is what is confusing.
Yes. In this diagram, there is nothing like C. Well, C is here. And here, I'm putting it.
Yeah, but then both of them have C, right? Both of them, both of the sigmas have a boundary.
In which picture?
Yeah, because
I don't understand what's confusing.
It's empty.
Yeah, that here you're saying that d sigma is empty, right?
Here I'm saying, so sigma is this piece of surface.
Yeah.
It has a one circle boundary, which I evolve in a cylinder, and that cylinder is now B.
Okay, yeah.
Of course, if I close these, B goes away, but I don't know how to draw things anymore, so I put this dotted line.
I see.
So you can think of closing this C to a point and making it disappear up and down. B disappears. But then how do I draw it? How do I draw where space-time is? I just put this dot. You say that it is the 3D space in between. In the ring picture, I would have one potato inside the other potato. And the 3D space in between these two surfaces would be my space-time. But it wouldn't look like anything on the blackboard, so I don't. Okay, so good. It's better to clarify these things at the beginning, so in drawings will be clear later. Now, there is an extra thing that I want to mention. This is the last piece of geometry. There is one normal, and at the corner, so this is called the corner, there is a b-normal, or binormal, I don't know. So this is epsilon AB, and is oh, I forgot the.
And can you just say, why are we writing sigma bar?
Oh, because the orientation is reversed. So here the normal is ingoing, here is outgoing. So I put a bar to remember that. It's just an orientation. So here is one. I think, don't quote me on this sign, but the idea is that this is the product. I just want it to be normalized to, probably this is normalized to a norm 2. Otherwise, or with the, there are different conventions. I can check what I chose in the notes. Forgot. So this is a square, and this is a plus. Nail. Okay.
Can I what was confusing was that we wrote del sigma on the right-hand side, even though the del sigma on this side, the sigma would be like a sub-sigma, sub-area.
Sigma is a 2D, what's confusing? The boundary of sigma?
Sigma would have been like a sub-area, right?
Oh, it's not the same as here. It's just a portion. But instead of, the problem is I could call this region R in M, and then I would have to invent a new name for this. It's too many names. So I just say sigma can have boundaries or not, and I will tell most of the time it will not. If it does, I will say it explicitly, and I call this boundary C. It's just a way, and M the same. I can say I want just all space-time or not. Instead of changing names, I just say whether there are boundaries or not.
Can you say the analogy of binormal on that 2D picture that you draw? It was a very good picture.
But the problem is that there isn't, because there is not enough space to fit. So it's just, it would be, an object with two antisymmetric indices in 2D is trivial. It's just a number.
But
because it's like a
NS are the normal vector of two type of boundary that we have, right?
Yeah. So you take the wedge product of these. So in
crossing them together, right?
So what is, if I know, let's say that sigma is the surface where the function t is equal to 0. So now I think of t as a map from spacetime into R. And n as a one form is defined is just dt. So the conormal is just dt. So I can do the same for b. I say that b is where my radial coordinate is equal to something. And now SA, big A, is dr. This is the conormal. The binormal, the co-binormal, is essentially dt dr. And if I have, and the volume elements on the surfaces are the Hodge duals of these guys. So this will give me the Hodge, the volume element on this surface sigma, that's on the surface B, and here on it would lose two dimensions, so it would be exactly a volume element. So that's why there is this anti-symmetrization and so on. And yeah, it's so I don't know if that's normalized, by the way. I need to do these things carefully because I get easily confused. It's more of a moral sketch. In fact, it's probably not. I would say that this is n over. Okay, so this is it for spacetime, and now we look at field space. So, what is field space? If I say that fields are sections of a fiber bundle, does that make sense to everybody? So if I have a fiber bundle F over spacetime, and I say that a field phi is a section of F. So let me do a couple of examples just to clarify. So first example is the scalar field. What is F? So in principle, one can do this very formally and work with non-trivial fiber bundles as well. We will only look at trivial bundles. So they will all be products. So this is M cross R. So this will be a real valued field. Sections in this case are just real valued functions. So what is a section? So I have spacetime down here. This is my fiber. My fiber bundle is this box. And a section is a map from here somewhere up there. Well, up there. So if the bundle is trivial, it's just a function from the manifold into the fiber. So it's, in this case, it's just a real valued function. And I will call this space, just by definition, I call it curly F, curly graphic F. And other cases are similar. So I don't know, Young-Mills, what is my fiber? So for the fiber bundle, if trivial, it could also be non-trivial. But if trivial, this is just M cross the Lie algebra. So these, well, no, sorry. OK, this is tricky. The fiber bundle here is tricky. But it because it's not a function valued in the Lie algebra, it's a one form valued in the Lie algebra. So these, let's not say what f is, because it will take, it's annoying, but in that case, there is a fiber bundle such that in this case, A is equal to one form from M into G. It's really not straightforward to identify the right bundle, but there is one. So you can just.
It's on the Lie algebra, right? If we think as A, not
B. Yeah, but the problem is that I want one forms, not functions in the Lie algebra.
Yet M is the manifold?
Yeah, so this is spacetime, and here is spacetime, and these are one forms valued in the Lie algebra. So these are, they have two indices, D, XA, and then there's also, there's a tensor in principle. This is finite dimensional. So sorry, not G star, just, I don't know. So this is a basis in the Lie algebra. This is the one form basis, and this depends on. For metrics, okay, for metrics, in fact, I can tell you what roughly what the bundle is two symmetrized copies of the cotangent bundle. So this is a symmetrized tensor product. Sections of these are objects with two lower indices, which are symmetric. So if I forget about the fact that should be have a definite signature, but which one should add on the side. But at that level, we can say that F is equal to sections of F with signature minus 1 plus. So in this case, roughly, modulo on the degeneracy and signature conditions is the symmetrized cotangent tensor product of two copies of the tangent. But again, this is just to set the stage. I will work more formally. I will just care about phi, and in specific examples, we know what they look like, and that's enough for us. We don't need to over formalize the problem. All fields in physics are sections of some bundle. Okay, the Higgs field would be some complex vector space because it's a scalar valued in some complex vector space. Now let's do differential geometry on these spaces. So I will treat, in general, I want some coordinates on this field space. And this is the analog of, let's say, xi on p. Or on, yeah, let's think of these as, or on M, just something finite dimension. Let's give P. As it may, so my field is not a point. This, when I write it like this, I'm using some coordinates. I can do field redefinitions that are like coordinate redefinitions. So, and this I and this x play this, the same role as this little index I, for example. So now, what's the next thing that I can look at is, for example, vectors on this space. So the way I will denote them is with a bold x, like these double struck symbols. So if I write it in component, I write it, and then we discuss why this makes sense. So we, oh, sorry, this is a partial derivative. We see the analogy. Here we are deriving, doing variations of my field, and this is how much the field is varying. People usually call this delta phi. So I just keep that notation. Here, the components are xi. It's just what is usually the way it's usually written. I could, there's no reason to try to make them look more similar, but it's the same thing. The fact is, functional derivatives are more complicated than partial derivatives. So this is a formal definition, and what we care about is to see how it acts on certain types of functional. So here, if I have a functional on phi, I can look at, so there are many ways of writing in these, which are all equivalent. The lead derivative of s along x, which is the same since it's a function of x, the derivative of s along x, which is the same as the contraction. I use this to introduce all these symbols. Of this is the most horrible one to do at the blackboard. Yes. So, and this is the analog of this. Okay, so let me be more explicit about what I find here. So here it's simple. I find this is equal to sum over I partial derivative of x, sorry, of xi df dxi. So here, what do I want to find?
Fixed field, right?
Sorry?
You think about S as a fixed field on a manifold, like a function on a manifold we already had, right?
X, big S.
S
is, if you want, is the, now I will use the action as an example of a function. So it's a function on field space. So we call it a functional because it's not on space time, but just a function on field space. So this is S of phi, that would be F of X. Yeah, of the point on. Should have called the point z, so not to say x too many times, but. Okay, so let's take the action as an example to see what this looks like, and we will see that it's familiar. And so we want to, so in the, let's say the physics way of writing things, which is totally fine, but to copy the Cartan's calculus is just useful to introduce the notation. So we can do the same manipulation as we were doing this week, but in field space without getting confused about notations. But most of the time, one writes this as just delta x of s. So is the variations of x under some variation delta x of delta phi, right? So this is the integral of ds over d phi times so if I forget about the fact that I put an x here, it's just the usual thing. I just put an x to remember that which variation I'm choosing is depends on the vector field I'm selecting. So these, however, to see that this is actually a non-trivial thing a priori, it's not just a sum over components, this object should be actually understood as a differential operator acting on this. There could be derivatives involved here. Because S does not just depend on phi, it also depends on the derivative of phi, like in the Lagrange. So this, if S, as usual, is the integral of phi partial phi. So this becomes I remove a bit of a few indices so that it's easier to look at. And here, of course, what we are instructed to do is this. So we are assuming in doing that this important right? This is just the way we always what we always do. And so the way of thinking about this is more like a differential operator acting on my variation, as we can see here. Okay. Now, if I want to copy, to write these in the form of the last equality, for example, I can also write these as the contraction of this field space vector with the one form. So what is this one form? Is dphi plus dl over dA phi. This is, right? So this I'm calling, this is what I meant by ds. This is like a 1-4. And these two commute. I don't.
Yeah. So like because the Lie derivative version is the variation. So this Lie derivative version?
Yeah, so the Lie derivative of a function along a vector field is just the derivative of the function by definition. But the Lie derivative is a concept that can be applied also to forms and other vectors. Whereas the usual derivative is just the usual derivative. Now, what I'm going to claim is that I can use all the usual formulas of Cartan calculus for these fat symbols. So these bold symbols are just work in the same way as the skinny one, the usual ones. OK, so there is one catch, which is in. Here I conclude, which is something annoying one has to deal with. And there are two ways of doing it, the way that mathematicians like and the way that physicists like. So the question is, here I'm using this derivative, but what about, so this becomes when I pull out the contraction. So the contraction just, let me write it here. This way, this is just, by definition, Ix of d phi, right? It's all consistent if you look up and down. That's the component of the vector field. So this is like saying that xi is Ix dxi. Well, dk, let's put this. A component of the vector field can be found by contracting the vector field with the d of the coordinate. So this is just the same equation. But
I don't see what is the partial there. Is it also some generalization?
Which here?
Just the partial derivative.
In which?
First, when we start writing
here.
Now we are.
I'm saying, in the case S has this specific form, this is the usual way I derive the Lagrangian. I think of phi as a variable without caring that it's a field, and I just derive that. So this is the usual Euler-Lagrange thing. I don't want to try to define things abstractly. It's just really not worth it. It's just a way to do computations, and I'm just saying, well, let's use this little heavier notation because it will pay off later. So I'm just trying to give you this. So to conclude, in here, where is it? This can now be written pulling out the I as dA delta d this big D phi. I need to get better at writing that. Is equal to d of partial phi. But what about, so this is just a partial derivative. What about d? So what about one forms? So what about this equation? Is dxa wedge d phi, if I have ever something like that, is this a wedge? Do I want them to commute or anti-commute, these two? So I will use the physicist choice, which is the easiest, which is I let them commute. Mathematicians like to let them anti-commute, because then you can think of these as forms in a bigger space, where phi and x are on the same ground. So that's a trick. And it pays off in beauty and formalism, and there is a lot. But for computations, it's a bunch of extra signs to track, and it's a pain. So why the two conventions eventually lead to the same results? Because what one is really computing physically are never forms on field space. These are always intermediate steps. What one is interested in are variations along some physically important directions. They're always scalar. So in the end of, at the end of the day, we're always going to contract everything and obtain scalars. And when we contract things with vectors, and we have to go across these d's and bold d's, we get more signs. And in the end, the two bunch of signs just cancel. So I will let them commute, but if depending who you read, some people do one thing, some people do the other. It's just, so I will let them commute. But I, so I can write these just as a D, and the D goes across, no problem. In some cases, yes, some authors will put a minus sign in this equation.
Somewhere now.
Yeah, I just write these, contract these with dxa, and I rewrite it abstractly with the d and the bold d. So if I multiply this equation by dxa, I can write it like that. In one case, the d is outside, and in one case, the d is inside. Yeah. Here is to the left, here is to the right, in a sense. So it depends on, so conventions can be a bit nasty to follow. That's what I'm trying to say. Like, I will just let them go across each other, and it will be OK. Some authors, more mathy authors, like to let them. This will change sign in the intermediate steps, but not in the final results, the physically relevant final. So that's it. Was boring, but finally we have everything we need to start with the Lagrangian and do the covariant field space. Certainly. Let me just check if there's something small that I'm missing. I don't think so. Yeah, maybe let me give this last super short thing.
Question first.
Yeah.
How do we know that the inner derivation commutes with the partial again? Like I and partial. How do we know this commute?
So if you want,
x depends on.
So you have a section.
Exactly.
We are assuming that these are changes in your section. So you are comparing two sections of your bundle. So let's write it like, so delta, How can I phrase this? If I think of a vector as an arrow that points between two points, that's like an infinitesimal difference between two points.
Right.
And so if I do this in field space, this way of thinking, I have two slightly apart sections, and now once I have the two sections, I can take derivatives, and the difference in the derivatives is the difference of the derivatives. So if I have phi 1 minus phi 2, and I take dA of these, I don't even think about it. It's just d phi 1 minus dA phi 2. And so this infinitesimally is some field space vector contracted on phi. And this is, I want this to be that. But if you work in jet bundles, if you know about jet bundles, this is not guaranteed on the jet bundle. So these are called evolutionary vectors on the jet bundles or local vectors. They just mean that they descend nicely to the section. You can pull. But the jet bundles contain so much more stuff, and you don't care about it in physical applications. So we're just not even mentioning it and just saying that these two operations commute. But it's because we are only interested in sections of the bundle and not in the jet bundle itself, which is way bigger.
Sure.
So jet bundles are places where phi and partial phi are considered like independent ones. Independent variables, independent directions in a huge space.
Yeah.
So here we don't want them to be independent. We want partial phi to be the derivative of phi.
Field space.
Hmm?
Jet bundles of field space.
No, they're bigger than field space.
No, the jet bundle constructed from field space.
Yeah.
Okay. Wow, that's crazy.
Well, not from field space. From the finite, from F, like not curly F, the jet bundle of straight F. Is a jet bundle, which is used by mathematicians to talk about local field theories, but we're only interested in that jet bundle, in points in that jet bundle that can be found. They're essentially just the section. So the derivatives, the direction that the J1 of phi must be the derivative of phi. Yeah, we just freeze that. We don't want to think. But this is tough. So the way I will denote this is just, sorry about this, but at least I don't. If I have a mixed form, something like this, mixed form of this kind, this would be a one form on space. And the one form on F. That's how I will denote them. It's just a notation, okay? So one, it means that there is a dx, and F one here means that there is a d phi. I could have omega kl forms, for example, if I add more pieces here, more pieces there. So this is the last thing I wanted to say to close the notation part of it. Thanks. Sorry for going a bit.
Yeah.